We have a choice. We can, as I said, we obviously can't go through the whole play today. That's impossible. So we need to focus in on certain things, look at certain things. The idea of having a mini performance or whatever is to match up the performance with the study, because what happens in, as it were, Shakespeare academic circles is that on one side you have the people who study the text, and on the other you have the people who play it out, and often they don't meet. That's beginning to change now, but that's not a very good idea. You need both. You need a little bit of scholarly study, which can help in all sorts of ways. Sometimes it gets in the way, but normally it helps. But also you need to experience it as a play, as it was meant to be heard. So that's what we try and do as far as we can with our rather limited budget and resources. Would you like to go through again the scene that we have just heard, or would you like to move on in the text? You'd like to move on. All right. We could look. I thought we might possibly look at... just bear with me one second. We have obviously there's the main plot, and then there are the subplots. And I thought it'd be quite good to just get a taste of one of the subplots. And you've all, I'm sure, heard of Caliban. And he is a strange figure. He was the son of Sycorax, we're told, who's a witch from Tunis. She eventually died, and he was left stranded on this island until Prospero and Miranda turned up. He was, as it were, the king of the island. And he, I suppose, represents what one might say the grossest aspect of human nature. He's described as kind of half fish, half man. But he really perhaps represents, as we're talking allegorically, that the grossest aspect of our nature, and all of us, of course, are possessed, at least potentially, if not actually, with some pretty gross stuff within us. So why don't we turn to 2:2? Has everyone got a copy, by the way? I've got one spare copy. You haven't? If you could share with your neighbour. I'm sorry, we didn't have many copies.
Hello, can I just ask you what I can remember from my studies? Are we looking at this particular character of Caliban from a post-colonial perspective or not?
We're keeping colonialism out of it.
But it's lauded as a very...
Well, yeah, in the 20th century, and particularly from the kind of 1970s onwards, when American scholars took over Shakespeare studies to a large extent, there was an emphasis laid, and of course there was a trend in any case, towards anti-colonialist feeling. And those who have those beliefs liked to use the Tempest as a vehicle for putting forward their beliefs. And what happened was that whereas before Prospero had been seen as a man of great wisdom and of the highest order, what happened was that the situation with Caliban was almost reversed, so that Caliban was seen as the hard-pressed native, shall we say, who was being domineered by this wicked colonialist Prospero. And one can play that game, and you can put anything you like on Shakespeare. Marxists have done it, feminists have done it, Freudians have done it, you name it. Everyone can put their own veneer over Shakespeare and use him as a vehicle for their thoughts and ideas. Personally, I'm not really interested in that. I'm just interested in Shakespeare. I'm interested in discovering what is underneath these plays, what they really mean.
I respect that. I just wondered if that was the particular slant you were taking and whether we should be aware of it or not.
Well, you can be aware of it, but in terms of what I'm trying to do today, I think it's completely irrelevant, because it's really one of those coverings that I think we need to remove. And we're all full of ideas, and we all like to manipulate things in various ways, but what would be nice if we could, as they say, stand under Shakespeare rather than stand over him. It takes a little bit of humility And humility is very important in relation to this potential evolution that may take place within any of us, which I think this play is partly about. So, let's just have a look at this strange creature, Caliban, who suddenly enters the scene on 2-2. And he is going to meet... This is the comedy bit, if you like. There's always a little bit of comedy to lighten things, and it gets a bit heavy. And he's going to meet up with Stefano and Trinculo, who have also been washed ashore. Stefano is a butler, and Trinculo is a jester or fool. And they have their own journey to undertake in this story, which is, as much as I say, an inner journey as an outer journey. So let's just hear this little passage. We'll go through Act 2, Scene 2, Caliban, all the infections that the sun sucks up. Yeah, has everyone got that? I may have a slightly different edition, but it's only slightly different. Now, who would like to read this? Part of the purpose of a day like this is to get an opportunity just to read it, to hear your own voice, and of course for everyone else to join in as the audience. Now, there's normally a deafening silence, but would anyone... You're happy to do it. All right, as you're closest. I would ask you to stand up, please. And if we could remember, you know, throughout everything we're doing today, this power of listening, I would mention this phrase, to hear with eyes. It's very different from what we call listening. It's really a practice of fine attention, so that the words and sounds are really taken in, and the silence from which they all emerge. So this is a real practice for the day. It's an incredibly powerful practice. And as we say, we're not looking for Dame Edith Evans impersonations or anything. It doesn't really matter. We just want to very simply hear the words. So... No, we don't. Can we turn the projector off?
I hope you can all understand a Scottish accent.
It's a Scottish Caliban, which is wonderful.
Strong Scottish Caliban.
You don't need that if you're in front of that.
Can you hear me?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. So, Act 2, Scene 2, enter Caliban with a burden of wood. A noise of thunder heard.
All the infections that the sun sucks up from bogs, fens, flats on Prospero Fall and make him, by inch meal, a disease. His spirits hear me, and yet I needs most curse, but they I'll not pinch, fright me with urchin shows, pitch me I the mire. Nor lead me like a firebrand in the dark out of my way, unless he hid him. But for every trifle are they set upon me, sometimes like apes that mow and chatter at me, and after bite me, then like hedgehogs, which lie tumbling in my barefoot way, and mount their pricks at my footfall. Sometimes I am all wound with adders, who with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness.
Okay, low now, low. Enter Trinculo, and then you go on.
So I'm a Trinculo.
Yeah. And what we've got to understand is that the Trinculo, when he landed, or was it Stefano? Sorry, no, it's... Stefano, who has found a butt of sack, and he's, if I may put it crudely, absolutely pissed. Sorry. Okay.
Is it me now?
Yeah, here comes a spirit.
Here comes a spirit of his, and to torment me. For bringing wood in slowly, I'll fall flat. Perchance he will not mind me.
Here's neither bush nor shrub to bear off any weather at all, and another storm brewing. I hear it sing in the wind. Yon same black cloud, yon huge one, looks like a foul bombard that would shed his liquor. If it should thunder as it did before, I know not where to hide my head. Yon same cloud cannot choose but fall by pailfuls. What have we here? A man or a fish? Dead or alive? A fish. He smells like a fish. A very ancient and fish-like smell. A kind of not of the newest poor John. A strange fish. Were I in England now, as once I was, and had but this fish painted, not a holiday fool there would give me a piece of silver. There would this monster make a man. Any strange beast there makes a man. When they will not give a doit to relieve a lame beggar, they will lay out 10 to see a dead Indian. Legged like a man, and his fins like arms. Warm, my troth. I do now let loose my opinion, hold it no longer. This is no fish, but an islander that hath lately suffered by a thunderbolt. Alas, the storm is come again. My best way is to creep under his gabardine. There is no other shelter hereabout. Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. I will here shroud till the dregs of the storm be past.
I shall no more to sea to see. Here shall I die ashore. This is a scurvy tune to sing at a man's funeral. Well, here's my comfort. Ha, 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 ha. The master, the swabber, the boatswain and I, the gunner and his mate, love Mel, Meg and Marianne and Marjorie, but none of us cared for Kate. For she had a tongue with a tang, would cry a sailor, go hang. She loved not the savour of tar nor of pitch, yet a tailor might scratch her where'er she did itch. Then to sea, boys, and let her go hang. This is a scurvy tune too, but here's my comfort.
Do not torment me all.
Stephen. What's the matter? Have we devils here? Do you put tricks upon us with salvages and men of Ind? Ha! I have no scape drowning, to be afeard now of your four legs. For it hath been said, As proper a man as ever went on four legs, cannot make him give ground. And it shall be said so again, while Stefano breathes at his nostrils.
The spirit torments me, oh.
This is some monster of the isle with four legs who hath got, as I take it, an ague. Where the devil should he learn our language? I will give him some relief, if it be but for that. If I can recover him and keep him tame and get to Naples with him, he's a present for any emperor that ever trod on neat's heather, leather.
Do not torment me, prithee. I'll bring my wood home faster.
He's in his fit now and does not talk after the wisest. He shall taste my bottle. If he have never drunk wine before, it will go near to remove his fit. If I can recover him and keep him tame, I will not take too much for him. He shall pay for him that hath him, and that soundly.
Thou dost me yet but little hurt. Thou wilt anon. I know it by thy trembling. Now prosper works upon thee.
Come on your ways. Open your mouth. Here is that which will give language to you, cat. Open your mouth. This will shake your shaking, I can tell you, and that soundly. You cannot tell who's your friend. Open your chaps again.
I should know that voice. It should be... But he is drowned, and these are devils. Oh, defend me.
Four legs and two voices. A most delicate monster. His forward voice, now, is to speak well of his friend. His backward voice is to utter foul speeches and to detract. If all the wine in my bottle will recover him, I will help his ague. Come, Amen. I will pour some in thy other mouth.
Stefano.
Doth thy other mouth call me? Mercy, mercy. This is a devil and no monster. I will leave him. I have no long spoon.
Stefano, if thou beest Stefano, touch me and speak to me, for I am Trinculo. Be not afeard, thy good friend Trinculo.
If thou beest Trinculo, come forth. I'll pull thee by the lesser legs. If any be Trinculo's legs, these are they. Thou art very Trinculo indeed. How camest thou to be the siege of this moon-calf? Can he vent Trinculo's?
I took him to be killed with a thunderstroke. But art thou not drowned, Stefano? I hope now thou art not drowned. Is the storm overblown? I hid me under the dead moon-calf's gabardine for fear of the storm. And art thou living, Stefano? Oh, Stefano, two Neapolitans scaped.
Prithee, do not turn me about. My stomach is not constant.
These be fine things. Am I if thee be not sprites? That's a brave god, and bear celestial liquor. I will kneel to him.
How didst thou scape? How camest thou hither? Swear by this bottle how thou camest hither. I escaped under a butt of sack, which the sailors heaved o'erboard by this bottle, which I made the bark of a tree with mine own hands since I was cast ashore.
I'll swear upon that bottle to be thy true subject, for the liquor is not earthly.
Here, swear then how thou escapest.
Swam ashore, man, like a duck. I can swim like a duck, I'll be sworn.
Here, kiss the book. Though thou canst swim like a duck, thou art made like a goose.
Oh, Stefano, hast any more of this?
The whole buck, man. My cellar is in a rock by the seaside, where my wine is hid. How now, mooncalf? How does thine ague?
Hast thou not dropped from heaven?
Out of the moon, I do assure thee. I was the man of the moon when time was.
I have seen thee in her, and I do adore thee. My mistress showed me thee, and thy dog, and thy bush.
Come, swear to that. Kiss the book. I will furnish it anon with new contents. Swear.
By this good light, this is a very shallow monster. I, afeard of him, a very weak monster. The man in the moon, a most poor, credulous monster. Well-drawn monster, in good sooth.
I'll show thee every fertile inch o' thy island, and I will kiss thy foot, I prithee, be my god.
By this light, a most perfidious and drunken monster. When his god's asleep, he'll rob his bottle.
I'll kiss thy foot. I'll swear by myself thy subject.
Come on then, darl, and swear.
I shall laugh myself to death at this puppy-headed monster, a most scurvy monster. I could find in my heart to beat him.
Come, kiss.
But that the poor monster's in drink. An abominable monster.
I'll show thee the best springs. I'll pluck thee berries. I'll fish for thee and get thee wood enough. A plague upon the tyrant that I serve. I'll bear him no more sticks but follow thee, thou wondrous man.
A most ridiculous monster, to make a wonder of a poor drunkard.
I prithee, let me bring thee where crabs grow, and I with my long nails will dig thee pig huts. Show thee a jay's nest and instruct thee how to snare the nimble marmoset. I'll bring thee to clustering filberts, and sometimes I'll get thee young scammels from the rock. Wilt thou go with me?
Now lead the way, without any more talking. Trinculo, the king, and all our company else being drowned, we will inherit here. Here, bear my bottle. Fellow Trinculo, we'll fill him by and by again.
Farewell, master, farewell, farewell.
A howling monster, a drunken monster.
No more dams, and I'll make for fish, nor fetch in firing at requiring, nor scrape trenchet, nor wash dish. Ban, ban, can Caliban has a new master, get a new man. Freedom, heyday, heyday, freedom, freedom, heyday, freedom,
Oh, brave monster, lead the way.
Well done. A round of applause, I think. Okay, I'd just like you to spend just a minute, just have a look through that scene again. Just remind yourself, perhaps pick out the odd phrase or word or anything that comes to light. Just reflect for a second. I hope everyone has access to the text. Yes, I think there's probably two kinds of madnesses. There's divine madness, which is probably wisdom. And then there's madness, which is rather different. We'll come on to that. I just wanted everyone to acquaint themselves again with the scene. Now, let's very simply ask ourselves, in the most, as it were, literal way, looking at the literal level of meaning, what is happening in this scene?
Caliban is regarding these two lowly creatures as being godlike. And wants them to become his master. His master.
Okay, but basically we're being introduced to them, aren't we? This is the first time in the play that these characters are introduced. So we need to mark down that fact that they represent. You know, what my whole thesis for today is that they represent something. That you can take them literally, but they also represent something. So. We're introduced, as it were, to this level of man, with capital M, and including woman, of course. So we're being introduced to this. So in the scene, there is humour. I mean, we couldn't obviously get it today, but when it's done properly on the stage, you've got two of these guys under the gabardine with their legs hanging out, and, of course, Stefano appears and thinks it's a monster. In relation to what I was trying to say about reality and illusion, and taking into account that when Shakespeare introduces a subplot, what he's really doing, I think, is reminding us of the main theme as a kind of echo. It's kind of echoed in the subplot. But he wants to turn our mind, I think, even through the subplots, to the central issues. So, in relation, if you remember anything that was said before, is there anything that you notice about this scene? You know, what is going on between the characters? What's happening?
I just feel that Caliban has been presented as the underdog.
Right.
And definitely as a lesser being and a lesser character. But then, usually in Shakespeare's plays, that the joker or the not the joker, the what's the word?
The fool.
The fool says something really poignant, and
yes.
I think Caliban has a very he's been introduced here as a very lowly, very underdog, but there's something terribly poignant about the part he plays.
Okay, well he is in torment in the scene at the beginning. You know, he is as was said, sometimes am I all wound with adders who with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness. So what's happened, and we, for those of you who don't know the story, is that when Miranda and Prospero first arrived on the island, they found this Caliban fellow, crude as he was, and they attempted to educate him. They loved him, they looked after him, and the relationship was very harmonious. But then, oh dear, he tried to rape Miranda. Prospero wasn't very pleased about this, and from that point on, he turned him into a slave. So there was a reason for his slavery. It wasn't that he was just turned to slavery. It was because of his attempted rape of Miranda, which also has a symbolic meaning. We won't go into that now. And so he is in torment at the beginning of this scene. He's being punished, effectively. He's been punished by Prospero, who is all-powerful in terms of the natural world, and he is in torment. And then suddenly, and remember in this play I've mentioned about seeing and points of view, that people are seeing things in different ways. They're seeing and experiencing worlds that aren't really there. That this has a poignancy, I hope, for us, if we take the general theme of what was said earlier. So he says right at the beginning, where are we? I've lost it. Here comes a spirit of his. So he thinks that Trinculo is yet another spirit come to torment him. So immediately there's, as it were, a misidentity, a misunderstanding, a misseeing. Yeah? Are we with this?
The true man, the true human being, is not recognized by either of them in each. They each think there's something else.
Yes.
Which just seems to be an interesting point.
That's right. And it's all a matter of the fact that they're living in a projection of what is there. They're not seeing what actually is there. Yeah, just like the cave of Plato, you can see the projection on the wall and take that to be reality. Or you can wake up and get rid of your chains and see things as they are. So this is the kind of theme that is, you know, Shakespeare as a dramatist plays with us. He creates resonances, sounds, he repeats words. All sorts of things are going on in the background. We're not even aware of it happening. But it is with a conscious intent. He's reminding us. He's, in his own way, awakening us to certain things. So right at the beginning, we have a tormented spirit and we have, as it were, a mis-seeing. Sorry, yes.
Following what you just said, I've always felt in reading that the gaps, spaces, and pauses between words are very significant. They seem to convey a very great deal. Would you agree?
Yes.
Thank you.
Silence speaks.
Caliban seems to be falling deeper into delusion. He seems to be being led deeper into, well, to repeat the same word, delusion,
yes,
by Trinculo and Stefano.
Yes. Who would like to develop this thing? What is actually happening here? What's happening? I've mentioned about this, the beginning of this scene. As we go through it, there's this interaction between Trinculo, you know, he's very rude about Caliban, he smells like a fish, a very ancient and fish-like smell, and so on. And then we have Stefano, the third part of this, who's singing and he's drunk, all right? So he's in a state of, God knows what world he's in, which is very much reflected in the language. And then he comes across these two, and so he's drinking away, and Caliban says, "Do not torment me." He still believes that this is a spirit sent to torment him. And then we have, as it were, Stefano's viewpoint. And he says, "What's the matter? Have we devils here? You know, do you put tricks upon us with savages and men of Ind, etc.?" So he sees a monster. He sees a four-legged monster. That's what he's experiencing. That's the world he's living in. I mean, you can imagine if you're, you know, you've had a few, and you can misdiagnose the situation, I find. And in this case, he's seen a monster with four legs, and he's responding to that. That's the projection that he's responding to. So immediately, we've got all sorts of projections and misunderstandings. Is that right? So you could ask yourself, well, why is Shakespeare bothering to do this? What's he saying? What else in this scene? Anything else that we have seen? What can we see in it?
I don't know if it's a point worth making, this gentleman, I don't know whether he works in it. It's a nice idea, but you were saying that Caliban gets led further into delusion as the scene progresses, and yet the gentleman, the butler, almost bring themselves out of the delusion into reality. They see things for how they are, more as Caliban goes deeper in. I don't know whether that's a side point or whether that's something that's...
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Once the monster story has unraveled, as it were, and Stefano and Trinculo rejoice in meeting each other because, again, they both thought each one was dead. So they were both living in a world where, you know, Stefano was dead or Trinculo was dead. But no, they've awoken to the fact that they're both alive. So that's another parallel. And then, of course, they give some drink to dear old Caliban, who is, as it were, a savage innocent. He's the other side of the coin from Miranda's innocence. And he takes a few drinks, and he gets very drunk very quickly, as people can do. And suddenly, what he sees and experiences is that Stefano and Trinculo are gods. For him, they have become gods. And for the rest of the story, until the very end, he will treat them, he will see them as gods to be served. And that's his world. That's his projection on the wall, if you like. Yeah?
Why does he finish the passage with freedom, Haydee? Freedom? I would think that was a very strong word.
It's a very strong
word. For a character who has taken the lower position, yeah, or been given a lower position.
Well, everyone in this play, and I would say everyone in this room, would like freedom. But what does it really mean? We're looking in this scene at three characters at the, as it were, the lowest level of humanity. They are engrossed. I mean, literally, they're obviously drunk. But essentially, their god, as it were, is the spiritual world, but not in the sense that Prospero would see it. They enjoy a good spirit, but they're not very interested in the spiritual world, it would seem, at this stage.
On his basic level, it's implying that he's free from Prospero's grasp. By now, is that what it is? By turning on to...
For him...
By following Stefano now, he's free from...
Exactly. He sees a route to freedom through these gods, Stefano and Trinculo, who will replace Prospero, who he describes as a tyrant. So in his world, Prospero, who is this great magi, this great man, in his world, he is a tyrant. He is wicked. And he is evil from his point of view. So it's another point of view. So the theme of freedom, as I said, the last three words of this play are "set me free." And you will see the word freedom echoed all through this play. And everybody is looking for freedom. But how do you find freedom? What does it really mean? It's very easy to say, let's be free. But what does it really mean? So I would suggest in this scene, we're seeing one aspect of that in the sense that all those characters are looking for freedom. Some people find their freedom in drink. Have you ever met people like that? They're called alcoholics. But seriously, that's, you know, why do they drink? Because they want to be free from, you know, whatever their personal nightmare may be. So this theme of freedom is really crucial. But Shakespeare being Shakespeare, he's showing us it and all aspects related to it from all sorts of angles and perspectives. And that's what we'll see perhaps more and more as the day goes on.
There's something there that reminds me...
Sorry, could you speak into the mic? Yeah.
That they're also saying... we can speak about our condition, the way we find ourselves at this particular moment, but we can also make choices. So even at that level of man, they're making their choices.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is where this question of justice and mercy comes in, because when you make a choice, the natural law or karmic law, whatever you want to call it, will operate. So that there are consequences. And as we see through the play, everyone's actions have consequences. And if you take the first, a bit of information we get at the beginning of the play that poor old Prospero and Miranda have been set in this boat and have landed up on this island, and Antonio, the wicked brother, has usurped the throne. This is a very common theme in Shakespeare, this idea of usurping the throne, which again has an inner meaning, which I won't go into right now. But, there are consequences when people do things like that. So Antonio eventually, along with Alonso, who supported him in this usurpation, falls into Prospero's web when the ship sails too close to the island, and he's able then to begin this drama, which is first of all a drama of revenge, which ultimately turns into a drama of forgiveness and redemption. And that is the journey of the soul that may take place for those, to quote Jesus, who have eyes to see and ears to hear. But along the way, there are all sorts of other journeys going on that are all, as it were, going in the same direction, but they're different according to those same laws that are operating. But as you say, at this level of being and understanding, what has been set in motion and will then be displayed throughout the play is the result of the decisions that these people are making. Later on, what happens is they're going to try and murder Prospero. There's another decision. And Caliban's going to lead the way. Yeah?
But the scene we've just looked at with the three of them, those three are parts of us.
You can see all the characters being aspects of our own being, yes. I mean, there are obviously different ways of reading Shakespeare, but I firmly believe that, yes, that they are. But I mean, if you just take it in a very general sense, we all know what it is to be gross. You know, we recognize it in others, and perhaps we recognize it sometimes in ourselves. You know, you are very identified with the physical world, shall we say, through the appetites. You know, you eat too much, you want to have sex every day or whatever it is. You know, I mean, any involvement with the physical world, an identification with the physical world, is an engrossment. And that's fine, that's all part of nature. But of course, there's another aspect of nature, which is a finer aspect of nature. And it's all a wonderful drama in any case. You need all of it.
But that scene is like three parts of one's lower nature in a battle for supremacy.
Yes, in a way, I think that's right. Things pulling against each other, and that's what it's like at that level, that you are very prone to divisions within yourself. Different things are pulling against each other, and of course, later on in the play, they get quite stroppy among each other, particularly Caliban and Trinculo argue a lot, and that's also indicative of exactly what you're saying, and it is a kind of inner division. It creates weakness. And also, it creates mistakes. You mistake. And that leads you on a particular path which you then have to, you know, through the laws of justice and hopefully mercy, you're then sent off on another path. So there's a lot in this, as they say. Yes.
I was reminded when you were speaking of freedom.
Yeah.
Of the communion service, which speaks of service and freedom being correlated, whose service is freedom. And the word liberation is a very familiar word in this house. What each individual is seeking, I have concluded, is frequently under the umbrella of freedom, or truth, or one's own true self. Does this find any echoes with you, please?
Yes. I mean, I think why this play... We're, at the end of today, we're going to particularly look at this in relation to, as I say, Shakespeare's, as it were, final words to us. That's the way I would put it. And as you already know, his last words are, "Set me free." And I think he gives us a lot of clues as to what that really means, certainly what it really meant for him, and indeed how freedom is possible. But we'll have to wait till the final session when I hope we'll begin to get into that. But it's a wonderful, I mean, it's really, I often find it very emotional, that the final part of this play, because it really is going to the very depths of what I would call true understanding and being. Yeah, hello.
Can I just say one final thing about the final thing that Caliban says, and to connect up with your point, Philip, about redemption and forgiveness?
Yeah.
I think Shakespeare's been really subtle when he says, "No more dams I'll make for fish, nor fetch in firing at requiring, nor scrape trencher, nor wash dish. Ban, ban, can Caliban has a new master get a new man?" And I think Shakespeare is preparing us, even at this very early stage, for the fact that this is a lot to do with forgiveness and redemption.
Indeed.
Because Caliban actually says, has a new master, referenced himself, and get a new man.
Yeah.
And I think that Shakespeare is preparing his right at the very early stages, as I say, without repeating myself.
I think you're right, yeah. And a new man is an interesting phrase. There's a wonderful book called The New Man, which I would recommend to anyone, by a chap called Maurice Nicol. Some of members of the Study Society here will know that book. It is about a new man in the sense of a rebirth. But of course, in this scene, what we are observing is a delusion. He's celebrating in a complete nonsense dream, really, because he has made his god or gods two of the lowest order of mankind, and he's made them gods. And he sees them as his ladder to freedom, perfection, whatever you want to put it. And this is a delusion, an illusion. And this is what the scene is showing us. We as the audience, as the observer, as the objective observer, are looking on this. But that is what's going on. And it's just like you observing what is going on in your own mind and the various characters and forces pulling and pushing against each other in all their various colours and forms.
Could you say something about the humour? Because it's so necessary to have the humour. And as you mentioned, Maurice Nicol, he had a sign above where he took a meeting saying serious things cannot be understood without laughable things.
Absolutely.
And it's the paradoxical need of that.
Yeah, well, this is a romance. So it's actually in the first folio of Shakespeare, 1623. This is the version, The Tempest. There's only one version of The Tempest, unlike some other plays, which appears in the first folio. And it's described as a comedy. And it's, in fact, the first play printed in the folio, and it is described as a comedy. Scholars or academics describe it as a romance, because the final four plays of Shakespeare, which is The Winter's Tale, Cymbeline, Pericles, and this play, are seen, as it were, as a final phase of his life, kind of regeneration plays, as they're described, or romances. But they do have elements of tragedy, of comedy, and other things within them. Now, from a dramatic point of view, comedy, of course, is crucial, because you have to mix and match what you're giving your audience. You can't have too much darkness, because they're all going to run away. You can't understand darkness without light. You have to have light to understand darkness, and darkness to understand light. So a man of this order, Shakespeare, knows exactly how to play with these elements. And he introduces comedy quite early on. But it's a kind of dark, light comedy, because when this is played out, you have a good laugh, you're laughing. But the other side of it is, these are the complete idiots. They're in complete delusion. So, you've got both at the same time. And this is where, as you said, Shakespeare is so subtle, because he's operating on all these different levels all the time. And he's playing on the audience's heart and mind all the time. And he knows what he's doing. Could you speak up? Sorry, can we just get you out? Yeah, just get that away. Just hold on a sec. Just hold. Sorry. Okay.
The god of transformation and drink and drama is all the same god, Dionysus.
Indeed.
He's born from the thigh of Zeus, the absolute, which is just a symbolic way of saying what you just said, that they all represent something from the absolute.
Absolutely, and of course, when we talked about the mysteries, they were the Dionysian mysteries in Greece, who were one of the main schools in relation to the traditions I was talking about earlier. And as we know, life itself, it's the two sides, isn't it, of comedy and tragedy. That is life. But the trick in the game is that beyond the comedy and the tragedy is something else, which we might describe as mercy, or whatever you want to call it. So you have to, the tragedy and the comedy have to be played out, and they can kind of cancel each other out and go round and round in circles. But then there is, as it were, a third element, and I think this play teaches us about the third element, although it gives us elements of tragedy, elements of comedy, and all the rest of it.
We haven't talked about Ariel.
No, we haven't.
No. Ariel, frightfully important, because really the play can't go on without Ariel.
No, they can't.
He makes magic.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he seems to, he, when Prospero says, well, I'll set you free for this.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, can you say something about, Ariel's very mysterious.
He is, yeah. Well, in a way, I'd rather not, because he's not in this scene, but I'd like to. But here's a bit of a mystery, really. In the Hebrew, Ariel, I think, means Lion of God, I think it is. Lion of God. And in the kind of mystery traditions, that seems to relate to the heart, the lion being courageous and spirited. And so he is, in the First Folio edition, described as an airy spirit. That's the only clue, as it were, that we're given. Now, obviously, Prospero can't do anything without him. He is his vehicle for doing all these incredible things in nature. The story, for those of you who don't know The Tempest, is that he was trapped on the island in a cloven pine, I think it is, by Sycorax, this nasty witch, the mother of Caliban. And he was freed, again freedom, he was freed by Prospero, and since then has become Prospero's servant. In this play, is promised freedom, but he can't get his freedom until he carries out the commands of Prospero. And eventually he is set free. So he's another one on a journey into freedom at his level of being, in terms of what he represents. Now, we've heard the songs of Ariel, and they clearly, as it were, are of another world, one might say. They are haunting. I would like to think of Ariel at the moment, and there's more that can be said about it. It is simply as the potential spirit within nature that can be unleashed. So you could look at Ariel as a kind of force of nature that is unleashed, that Prospero utilizes, but which, at a, shall we say, more ethereal level, also has its journey to undertake and also desires freedom from any limitation, because freedom means no limitation. So even when you have the powers that Prospero and Ariel obviously are given, they are still limited beings. That's really important to understand that. That is not freedom. Freedom is limitless. Anything else is a limit. So even at the finest levels of nature, whatever forces may be operating that we're not even aware of, perhaps, there are limits. And even those elements in nature desire, I would say, freedom, which some people describe as union with God. You can use your own terminology. It doesn't really matter.
On the importance of lightness and humour and laughter, I can remember Dr. Rolls in this house amusing us, and as the laughter died away, he would then say something he really wanted us to remember. It seems to have something to do with centering our attention. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would, because what laughter does is it releases. You know, when you laugh, there is release. We've been talking about freedom. And with laughter, at a certain level, there is freedom, there's a release. And a dramatist like Shakespeare knows when to drop in a piece of knowledge or information. And often he will use humour as a way, as you say, of releasing the audience. And then suddenly, plop, he'll just put in something. And he does this in all his plays in various ways. He will change the meter of his lines. As you noticed just at the end there, he suddenly goes into rhyme. He's playing with words and sounds in order to alert us, whether we're aware of it or not, to certain things. And this works in the most magical way.
I was just going to say that, do you not think that delusion actually is a tool for the truth? It needs to be there
Absolutely.
For the truth to be revealed.
Absolutely.
So it's actually very valuable.
It is valuable, but it depends whether you get lost in the illusion or whether you can escape from it.
Oh, of course.
If you're lost in the illusion, which is what happens to a lot of people in this play until, obviously, things play themselves out, it is a kind of madness.
Absolutely.
Because living in a world that is not there is really madness, isn't it? And that's what is being displayed. So you need it all. I mean, it's all, you know, people say you should have this, this is good, this is bad. That's just the mind. You know, there's nothing good nor bad, but thinking makes it so, you know, from Hamlet. This is how the mind operates. But it's all perfect. It all has its place, and the illusion is perfect. And it's there, one might say, for a reason. But when you're lost in the illusion, it can get a bit dark.
Oh,
a bit dark.
So by implication, would you agree that there is a part of us which is observing what is happening?
Well,
certainly,
yeah.
As an actor, is there a part of one which is checking what one is doing, please?
Well, there's the false observer and then there's the true observer. The false observer you can see as the chattering mind, the person within us who may take various forms, various characters within us, various souls within us, who is always commenting. I like this, I don't like that, I'm very good, I'm not very good. And all the rest of it, and this goes on, and that's the false observer. A good actor knows to leave that behind, and his constant practice is to get his attention on the words and the text.
Just a very quick point from an actor.
Yeah, from an actor, please, yes, speak.
If you haven't heard of it, it's almost gone down in legend, a very famous production of Hamlet by Daniel Day-Lewis, who went so method into the part that he utterly, utterly believed everything that was going on. He then started, as Daniel Day-Lewis, started seeing images and visions of his own dead father.
Yeah.
Because he was so engrossed. And so he got to a stage where his mind became unaware of what was real and what wasn't real. Some people view this as perfection of method acting. Personally, I see it as a very dangerous mind. We are conscious of a very small percentage of how our brain works. It is phenomenally powerful, and it should always be respected. So from an actor's point of view, by all means, immerse yourself, you'll hear people talking, in the role. But there will always be, and should always be, an element and a small part of you that is observing and is aware of what is taking place at any given time.
Thank you for that, because that is a famous instance, and he did literally lose it completely, and that is what can happen. But just quickly to return to this differentiation between the false observer and the true observer, one of the points you'll notice in this play that he says again and again, attend, attend, listen. Now, we're not normally, I would suggest, aware of what one might call the true observer because we're so involved and embroiled with our own mental structures, shall we say, our own thoughts and emotions and all the rest of it. But from an acting point of view, and you please speak about this, but it applies to anything really, is that when you really get your attention precisely on what is there, and acting obviously the words and the sounds, so there's nothing else, nothing in the way, there's just the connection in the present moment. At that moment of connection, at that point, and it is a point of attention, one can be aware of the body moving, of the words coming out of the mouth, of the sunshine, or whatever it is, but it's all under this observation, this total and utter detachment. So on one side, there's the drama going on, and it's fine, but through this power of attention, through this precision, one can be made aware, one can wake up to this, what I would describe as the ultimate observer, that is, as it were, not only the substance of everything that is going on, but is also at the same time the observer of it. And this is a great paradox that all spiritual traditions talk about. So there is a differentiation there.
As you were talking, I found myself thinking it's almost a kind of listening with the heart attention.
I think it is. I often quote the sonnet, "O learn to read what silent love hath writ, to hear with eyes belongs to love's fine wit." And I think the true hearing, not the listening, the general kind of listening, the true hearing Which, in fact, all spiritual traditions talk about this, and the mystery traditions are related to this. Everything, all the so-called spiritual disciplines and all the rest of it, which are really just means of letting go of the rubbish, of the coverings, of the elements that we inherit in various ways. And they are to get a person to a point, and I think this is the very heart of the so-called mystery traditions, to get them to the point where they can hear the word. The assumption is that anyone can hear the word. You can read the Bible or whatever it is, but can you hear the words of Jesus Christ, shall we say, or the words of Shakespeare or whatever? I would suggest that ain't so easy. But sometimes, miraculously, and as I was pointing out, I didn't have time to go through other things that Peter Brook, I often quote on these things. He was brilliant on the whole question of theatre. But the whole point, he says, about theatre is to get people into the moment. Even if it's just one moment in a whole production, you spend all this time and you've got costumes and actors and preparing the theatre and all the rest of it. But he says the whole point of it, if just for one moment, one person hears something, connects in the present moment, then that has been a worthwhile evening. For him, and this is a man, the greatest director, I think most would acknowledge, of the last 50 years. So this is not just me rabbiting on about spiritual things. It is a practical matter. And this is the magic, you know, this is a play about magic. Now, we haven't got time today to talk about magic because in the Renaissance times, their conception of magic is very different, or was very different to our conception of magic. But it basically relates to what one might call the metaphysical realm. And for them, there were natural laws operating at a metaphysical level and that these could be understood and harnessed in various ways. It doesn't matter whether we believe it or not. That was how they saw it. And that was, of course, the atmosphere and the climate that Shakespeare was working in as a man of the early 17th century.
I went to a performance of Measure for Measure at the Barbican a few years ago, and the director imposed a pause in the middle of a line where a character saw the conflict between what he was doing and what his conscience said. The theatre was silent. The pause lasted about a million years. I mean, a few seconds, but it was an absolutely amazing introduction, just in the middle of a line of verse to stop.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, moments like that can change someone's life. I know people where this has happened. I've certainly experienced it myself, very rarely, but what I would call magical moments where, I don't know, you can describe it, it's so difficult with words, but where you basically, in my experience, you experience this unity of being. The personal self completely disappears from the situation, and really what you experience is pure love, actually. Funnily enough, also in terms of speaking of vision and how one perceives the world at any moment, in my experience, what happens is that the world is perceived much as a dream drama. A wonderful dream, beautiful dream, but it's a dream. And as we'll hear later on, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. So on that note, I think it's time for lunch. Thank you.